The following program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.
This is Charles Ruas welcoming you to a program from my audio archives from the 1970s. As Director of Arts Programming at WBAI-FM, the Pacifica radio station in New York City, I produced programs that covered all the contemporary arts, including drama, literature, and experimental radio programs as well.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
But one warning. Some, and only some, will keep right on as they have done, may be called, in all justice, irresponsible and immoral, will eat too much and drink too much and go on sponging off their relatives even as they insult them, will betray their friends, will be guilty of sudden mysterious treacheries, will leave their wives to support little babies, will even corrupt the young and teach them reprehensible practices. And these monsters will share certain particulars, could be said to regress in the same ways. That is, they trust no one and nobody, certainly not themselves. They look at all of the world as Gauguin did when he said, the world being what it is, one dreams of revenge. They look at all that is close to them and to those that love them with suspicion, save language alone, which they honor and trust, and turn to in all situations requiring appeal. If they can be said to be loyal, it is only to language. If honest, by the honor of thieves to certain other poets, to certain powers which, in the right hands, could blow up the real world.
The voice you have heard was that of Violet Lang. Tonight we are presenting a program about this gifted poet. Violet Lang, known to all her friends as Bunny, was a Bostonian. During her short life, she was one of the founders and the moving force behind the Poets' Theater in Cambridge, Mass., which flourished during the 1950s. Some of the young artists and writers whose work she helped to promote were John Ashbery, Edward Gorey, Kenneth Koch, James Merrill, Frank O'Hara, and Richard Wilbur. This evening, you will hear the novelist Alison Lurie, one of Bunny's closest friends, read from her memoir, once privately circulated shortly after Bunny's death, and now published as the introduction to the collected works of V.R. Lang, published by Random House. You will also hear poets John Ashbery, Robert Merrill, novelist D. Wells, and Irish critic and writer Mary Manning, reminiscing about Violet Lang and the early 50s in Cambridge, Mass. First, we will hear Alison Lurie reading from her memoir of Violet Bunny Lang.
This memoir was written almost 20 years ago, not for publication, but in an attempt to record and save part of my world which had just disappeared. For me and many of her friends, Bunny's death was a first serious experience of mortality. It wasn't just elderly relatives who died, newspaper casualties and the pawns of war. One of ourselves, even the Queen, could be lifted off the board as succinctly as a jumped piece in chess. It was hard for us to get used to the idea. For months afterwards, we would find ourselves imagining that we saw Bunny at the end of a street, starting to dial her telephone number, setting aside some story to tell her, thinking how she would laugh when she heard that Gregory Corso had actually... And then remembering that she couldn't laugh, because her mouth was full of earth. For years I used to dream about her. I would go on longer and longer journeys by bus and train and on foot to find her in some large, strange house, oddly dressed. "I've been very ill," she would tell me, "but I'm getting better now." In my last dream, she was upstairs in bed in a boarding house by the sea on a cold winter day. The room had gray, pink-sprigged wallpaper and a view of the empty ocean. Bunny spoke to me. She moved her lips, but no sounds came out, so I don't know what she was trying to say. All of us tried to keep Bunny alive by referring current events to her opinion, quoting lines from her letters and poems, guessing and even arguing about what she would have said of this or that film, marriage, poem, or person. David Jackson and James Mill attempted to get in touch with her spirit through their Ouija board, producing long transcriptions in which Bunny's views and conversational style were oddly like their own. In their defense, it must be admitted that when she was in the mood, Bunny could and did alter her views and style to suit her audience. Of course, whenever someone dies, each of the survivors is left with a slightly different image. With Bunny, who had so many moods and roles, these images were perhaps more different than usual. It is quite likely that there are people who will recognize almost nothing in this portrait, or at least feel that my emphasis is all wrong. Time alters the meaning of the past as well as our memory of it. I wrote about a private matter and private persons, some young writers and a provincial little theater group. Now a long, scholarly study is being made of the Poets Theater, and the names and subsequent adventures of many of its members are literary history. It is only accident that the name V.R. Lang is not among them. If she had lived, she would certainly have taken her place in the so-called New York School of Poets, along with her friends John Ashbery, Kenneth Koch, and Frank O'Hara. Her poems are occasionally so much like O'Hara's that one which was found among his papers, To Frank's Guardian Angel, was printed as his in the recent collected edition. Indeed, I think that if she were still alive, Bunny would now be better known than any of us, not because she was a better writer, but because she was a woman, and a special kind of woman, one who combined literary talent with great organizational ability, driving energy, and a gift for publicity. Many of her poems are what would now be called feminist. Her two last plays, Fire Exit and I Too Have Lived in Arcadia, both have central female characters who prefer a lonely independence to the emotional deceits and defeats of failed romantic love. Bunny was a feminist before the movement was reinvented, in the dark ages of the early 1950s, when it was much less popular to be a single female of independent mind and professional ambition than it is now, when any girl who didn't really want to stay home and keep house for a man and a lot of children was apt to be told by her friends and psychiatrists that she had not accepted herself as a woman. Considering what she was able to accomplish in that hostile climate, it seems only logical that she would have been even more successful after the weather changed. My hope in publishing this book is to take advantage of the good weather and give V.R. Lang and her work some of the attention that she loved and deserved. I think the best of her work is in this book. She did write some other shorter plays, and there's a lot of earlier poetry, but I think that Bradley Phillips, her husband, has made a very good selection for this volume here.
Allison, how did you first come to know Bunny yourself?
I knew Ted Gorey, who was one of the original members of the Poets Theater, and he invited me to, I think it was the second or third meeting they had when they were organizing it, and I met her there.
I always thought of her with a host of male friends. I always thought of her as among a circle of men who worshipped and admired her.
Well, I don't think that's true. She also had women friends. She happened not to have, at the time I knew her around Boston, any women friends who were writers. But she certainly had women friends, and Dee Wells was her best friend for a long time. They were together in the Canadian WAC.
Was she interested in your work? I mean, did she know? Were you writing at the time?
Oh yes.
Yes.
Well, I wrote a couple of short plays for the Poets Theatre myself, and Bunny directed both of them and appeared in one of them.
What about her attracted you so much?
Well, I think as I tried to say in this introduction, she was the only young woman I knew at the time who wasn't involved in domesticity. The only one who hadn't set aside her own professional interests or ambitions in favor of her husband's career and having children and so on. And I think that was very important to me. I don't think I was conscious of it. I don't think I... If you'd asked me then, why do you like Bunny, I would have said, well, she's just so interesting and charming and fun, and wherever she is, things are happening. I don't think I would have... I might not have been so aware of this part of it.
You did manage to sort of follow your own career despite marriage or along with marriage.
Think how long it took me. I was published somewhat when I was in college and just afterwards, and then for 10 years I published nothing except three children.
Was this really a conscious choice on her part to be as independent as she was, do you think?
Well, I know that she was scornful of people who would have liked to collect her as their wife. And she was so deeply involved in her own career and her own life that she couldn't imagine dwindling into a wife. It would have been unthinkable for her. With Bradley, of course, that when she married Bradley, that was only a year before she died, and she well knew what that was a different thing, and that wasn't taking on the job of being someone's housewife and the mother of someone's children and following them from job to job. It was a very different thing than I and most of my friends were involved in.
Do you know what her working habits were? I mean, how much time she gave to her work? I gather from the book, it was rather...
They were very erratic. I can't say more than that.
Yeah.
Sometimes I know she'd work through the night. Sometimes she would jot something down on the back of a napkin. I don't think there's any pattern to it.
She cut quite a striking figure in Boston at the time, didn't she?
When she chose to, yes. She was of medium height and rather heavy, with firm, fair, heavy flesh. Her hands were broad, with short fingers, her face molded in low relief, like a face made in clay by a child. There was something childish, too, in the full pout of the mouth and the placing of the rather round eyes. On this simple base, Bunny built her many appearances. Her drawers were filled with extra attachments, long golden switches of hair, bunches of curls, every shade from peroxide to henna, pink sponge rubber breasts, thick false black eyelashes, artificial fingernails like fragments of seashell. A green tin box of theatrical makeup stood always open on her dressing table. She had trunks and closets of clothes put away all over the house and never threw anything out that could be worn. What was no longer a dress would become a costume. Whole poetic plays were often clothed out of these trunks and closets. After the play had closed, Bunny always went round and took her things back, and sometimes other people's things as well. What was no longer a costume would become a dress, if the distinction can be made. Since her weight varied from season to season and year to year, from about 125 to 150, at any one time, she could only wear part of her collection. She would pull something out of a closet and use it until it was filthy. Then it would go to the cleaners, unless Bunny happened to be broke, and back into the closet. perhaps for 5 years. A few things were constant year after year. Men's navy cotton jerseys or sweatshirts, torn blue sneakers showing her painted toenails, and an old trench coat faded to white and soiled to brown, which did not keep off rain. This was the costume in which for 6 years Bunny attended Poets' Theater meetings and rehearsals. She also usually wore it when writing, although not always. I remember in May 1951 finding her before her typewriter in an old starched and stained cook's uniform, about size 42. But ordinarily she liked to have appropriate dress for every activity. I saw her in this uniform again only when she was down in the basement kitchen cooking, or, doing a later phrase, mixing cosmetics.
Violet Lang was from Boston herself.
That's right. She was born in Boston and grew up there, even though she went to the University of Chicago, and where she founded the Chicago Review and was its first editor, and she was also away for some years because she joined the Canadian WAC. But when she got back to Boston, she found the Poets' Theater just getting started, and she joined it and was in on the first production.
Who were the members of that original group?
The original founders of the Poets' Theater were mainly connected with Harvard. The theater was founded by mainly Harvard undergraduates with the help and encouragement of some older poets who were at that time teaching at Harvard. The original founders were, in alphabetical order, Hugh Amory, John Ashbery, Edward Gorey, Donald Hall, William Matchett, George Montgomery, Frank O'Hara, and Lyon Phelps. And they had the advice and help and encouragement of Richard Wilbur, John Chardy, and Richard Eberhardt. Bunny Lang wasn't at the first meeting, I believe, although I'm not sure because I wasn't there. My memory is that she came to the second or third meeting, and I know she was in on the first production.
Do you know why she moved back to Boston? Why she moved back in to live with her family? It seems for a person who was tough and who wandered around and who was ambitious that somehow to move back to Boston and pick up with a group of Harvard students would have been, in a way, come down.
I can only speculate. First, that Bunny was very fond of her father, who was living alone as a widower in this house in Boston, and would have liked to see her again after her years away. Second, that it allowed her room and board to get on with writing poetry and plays, and prevented her having to take a full-time job.
She wasn't in a position of, she wasn't just a rich
she didn't
girl
have an independent income at all.
Well, now she went down to New York for a certain amount of time.
Oh, yes, she visited New York from time to time, certainly.
But you don't feel that she would have moved to New York? Most of the people that were involved in the Poets' Theater all seem to have ended up living in New York.
And it's possible that if Bunny had lived, she would have done the same.
Can you recall or define offhand the particular tone she gave the Poets' Theater as its director,
I think she
producer?
Made it more theatrical. She was more interested in the drama for its own sake than most of the people in the Poets' Theater. They were interested in poetry. She was interested in the theater as well as poetry. And she was always pressing for larger productions, more money spent on sets and costumes and advertising, longer runs, more hiring of professional actors to help out the amateurs that we had. And I think that that was one of her influences, certainly. She also, because she wasn't at the same time going to Harvard or teaching at Harvard, had much more free time to devote to the project. And I think everything became more intense and crowded together than it might have been without her.
She had a particular knack for discovering talents or encouraging people to write plays who ordinarily wouldn't have.
I think that's true, and I think that many of the people whose names I've mentioned would never have written their plays without her encouragement, or at least the encouragement of the Poets' Theater as a whole. And several people who have never written plays before or since, produced some rather good dramas. For instance, Ted Gorey wrote a play called Amabel or The Partition of Poland, which is really brilliant, although he had never written a play before or since. Among the plays that were written by members of the Poets' Theatre, which have attracted some notice and often productions since, were John Ashbery's Heroes, Frank O'Hara's Change Your Bedding, and there are many other plays produced first by the Poets' Theatre, which have been done later, although they weren't written by current members of the theater. James Merrill's play, William Alfred's first play, Agamemnon, was done by the Poets' Theater. One of MacLeish's plays,
The Trojan Horse.
Louis Simpson's Good News of Death was done first by them.
Do you feel that it was her driving force that kept the Poets' Theater going? It went on for a couple of years after she died, a few years after she died, but it seemed...
I think that she was one of the people that kept it going.
In the book, you said, you talked about how they got readers from England, mainly, to mm-hmm. read, to raise money. Mm-hmm. Well, at another point, you said that one of the books that Bunny had was Edith Sitwell. I feel that she must have admired Edith Sitwell greatly.
It's possible to admire someone's work and still be ironic about their public appearance. I think that her style was completely her own. I think she could put on the Edith Sitwell look, as she, in fact, in one of her letters tells me that she did. But that was just one of her costumes. She wrote me a letter in which she said she was asked to doctor a script of a play for Boston Club. She was asked to do this free. So she said to me, I have to go out this afternoon and talk to them, and I'm going to dress as a poet filled with cloudy dreams and floating silk chiffon scarves, and stare at them with gentle bewilderment when they pose their problem, which is to fill their awful book with wisecracks. Oh, I'm going to say, but there must be some misunderstanding. Did Ed tell you all my experience has been in poetical tragedy? But perhaps he didn't understand. And ruffle my hand through my towsley hair, and purse my white mouth, and rattle my beads, mumbling vaguely at them. Durate. That was her Edith Sitwell pose, which she could certainly put on when necessary, but she could take it off as fast as she put it on. Her involvement was as different as the people she was involved with, and the reports on what it was like to be friends with Bunny vary from person to person. I don't think I could possibly make any generalization.
For example, I've heard so many rumors of her early discovery or encouragement of Corso's work.
I just remember meeting him for the first time in the restaurant in Harvard Square, in which what I mostly remember is that I looked under the table to pick up something I dropped, and I saw that he had his hand on the knees of two different people, one on each side of him. Oh, I shouldn't say that. You can't say that. He'll hate me for that. And I just won't tell you who they were.
Oh, that's completely unfair.
It seems interesting about Bunny. One of the things that's quite interesting is the different kind of friends she had, the life she led as a WAC down in New York, in Chicago, and then the fact that she lived in this Bostonian house with her father.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems she was made up of a series of contradictions.
That's true. But maybe we all would be if we dared.
Did you take her seriously as a writer?
Oh, yes.
But as a promising writer, because throughout your memoirs, there's such a sense, elegiac sense, of the possibilities in her.
Most of the writers I know, if they had died at 32, would be completely unknown. That's not true of everyone. A few of my friends have produced really first-rate work when they were very young. But not all, so I can only think that Bunny would have gone on getting better and better, as she was doing.
Do you feel that Bunny Lang put the essential of her character into her work?
Yes, I think she put many of her different characters into her work. Certainly her two plays were both written for heroines who had something in common with her. Not, of course, that it would be possible to write a play in which all of Buddy's aspects would be given to the heroine. But in Fire Exit, you see a side of her, and you see another side of her in I Too Have Lived in Arcadia, which is the play she wrote after she returned to Boston from New York for the last time and gave up, I think, the possibility of a further life for herself. It was at this time that she realized she was going to die and that she wasn't going to go on to New York to this man she was in love with and have a new life here, but rather that she was going to go back to Boston to live out the months or years that remained to her, which, as it turned out, were very few. It was then that she wrote this last play, I Too Have Lived in Arcadia, which is based very loosely on her situation at the time.
Coming in the crowd. We, amiables, thumpers, animals, tumblers and performers of a very little fate, might have forgiven him for all he did was stare at us. Had he but acknowledged us, sadly, his complicity. We only asked he suffer that complicity. We were his family and wept for disavowal. He stood outside the ring in proud disguise. He masked his audience. He might at least have clapped his hands, applauding us, acclaimed our dance in bottle green. But he who danced for no one clapped his hands at nothing. Oh, by his scorn of us, he orphaned us to shame. The children grew distorted in his glance, the women plain. And all of our pleasant antics seemed ridiculous. Even our marching animals seemed ridiculous. There were those of us who hated him and disappointed children. And we did not forgive him who betrayed us by denial, whose mockery was immobility throughout our grand performance. But had we seen the child take aim, we surely should have stopped him. The child, the murderer who delivered us, who shot him, who severed head from neck with sprung cork of his pop gun. Oh, when we knew, we flew to him with pity in our eyes, to find he was not real at all, but bound to joint with wires. He was our blood. How should we know he was a dummy? No one of us before has been a dummy. We bade him rest and stood about in strong variety, sat in our bright parade of pantaloons of colored hose, and all of the leaning curious, the paint concealing the wonder on our faces, bent to look at him. Then, where there would have been, from children, laughter, the eldest of us scolded us severely, saying, "Let his assassin weep for him. Let melancholy women fold on his sawdust heart his hands by his paper sword."
John Ashbery talks with Charles Ruas about V.R. Lang and the problems of verse drama.
I first met Bunny in the spring of 1949, shortly before I graduated from Harvard. I met her and Frank O'Hara at about the same time, just a month or so before I left Cambridge. It was very nice to have finally met some really good friends, but I left, as I say, and moved to New York that year. And so I wasn't really in at the beginning of the Poets Theater, which I think sort of started the year after I was gone. It seems to me that Lyon Phelps was the main person, at any rate that I knew, who was interested in getting this started, and a great deal of talk about a theater to put on plays by poets.
Was Frank O'Hara at that time very keen on staging plays by poets?
And I know that he had already written some plays at that time and would no doubt would have liked to have them performed, as I had myself. I had written a short verse play called Everyman, which the Poets Theater did do in 1951, I believe. I wasn't really very happy with the medium. and which was very much in the news at that time. It was at the time that Eliot's cocktail party was done in New York, and The Ladies Not for Burning by Christopher Farley. There was sort of an attempt to revive verse in the theater, and which I didn't think was very successful. I didn't care for Eliot's plays very much, and I have a kind of aversion now, which I dates from that time, towards poetry in the theater, which is, I'm sure that it can be very good, but for me it's something like opera in English, which it just is not for me. And I've written plays since then, but they're not verse, they're prose. I think the theater is already poetry enough in itself, just being there is a sort of a convention-like poetry, and that they have actors speaking contemporary verse is almost redundant.
Are there any verse plays produced by the Post Theater subsequently that you did like?
Well, I didn't see very many of them because I, that time, was no longer in Cambridge, except for my own play, Every Man, which caused me acute embarrassment when I saw it.
Why?
I don't know. It just made me terribly uncomfortable. I think I left the theater. And I also acted in a play that Frank had written, which was sort of a celebration of Bunny Lang, and she and a friend of hers were characters in it. I was kind of the chorus, I believe. My usual fate.
Subsequent to that, you moved to New York?
Yeah, I came to New York right after I graduated from Harvard in the summer of 1949 and lived here up until 55 when I went to Europe and ended up staying there for 10 years in France. Right before I went to Europe, I wrote a play in prose which was put on by the Poets Theatre while I was in France and which I therefore never saw. It was called The Compromise. And Bunny was in it and was supposed to be very good. She played a sort of blonde floozy in the Yukon, a sort of... the play was kind of based on old movies, and she was probably sort of like Klondike Annie or something like that. After that one, I wrote another play, which I never actually finished, although I pretended that I had. I decided to make it a one-act play because I could never go on and write the next two acts, which were supposed to be there. So there's that one, which has never been performed to my knowledge. That one's called The Philosopher. And I'm writing one, I have been writing one for the last year or so, sporadically, which is much more experimental and closer to my poetry, although it's not what you'd call verse, which I guess my poetry isn't either at this point.
John, who produced Heroes?
That's a one-act play, which I wrote shortly after coming to New York, and it was performed briefly by the Living Theater as a curtain raiser for Ubu Wa, which they did a marvelous production of, which was in the Cherry Lane Theater, and unfortunately the theater was closed 2 days after the plays opened by the fire department, but apparently because of the scandalous nature of both plays, or what was considered scandalous at the time, which certainly wouldn't be today.
What was the prurient element in your play?
Oh, well, my play wasn't prurient at all, but there was a scene where two men were dancing together at the end, which was considered very shocking at the time. And the first word in Ubu, of course, which occurs all the way through the play, is a word that I don't think I'm allowed to say on this radio station.
It would bring the fire department in again, I'm afraid. Heroes was first performed by the Living Theater,
mm-hmm.
and then subsequently it was staged again.
Yes, the next year it was performed by the Artists' Theater, which was directed by Herbert Maitches. It was on a program with James Merrill's play, The Bait, and a play by Barbara Guest called The Lady's Choice, with sets by various painters. Mine had sets by Nell Blaine.
Was there any connection between the Artists' Theatre and the Poets' Theatre in Boston?
No, but some of us were involved, Frank O'Hara in particular, were sort of involved in both groups. And I think that the Artists' Theatre, which was more or less the brainchild of John Myers, who ran the Tibor Denagi Gallery and published pamphlets of poetry by various poets, including Frank and myself. He might have, you know, been influenced to do so by the fact of the Poets' Theatre in Cambridge and thinking there should be something like it in New York.
So while you were in New York, you continued seeing Bunny Lang?
Yes, I did. She was in New York fairly often at weekends, and I usually saw her when she came down. There, somebody would give a party, or we'd all go out and have dinner, and it was always kind of a rather festive occasion when she arrived in town, because she was, there was something very special about her that made you want to get dressed up when you saw her.
Which of her poems, sir, are you particularly fond of now?
I particularly like this one called Death of Another Swan, Miami, which begins with a French quotation, which, if I'm not mistaken, is from Les Mamelles de Tiresias of Apollinaire. Mon Dieu, quelle catastrophe! Il me devait 4 francs. My God, what a catastrophe! He owed me 4 francs. 1. Savage now with hunger at midwinter, still grasping at the plunder of the swifter, she begged, in order to be able to steal, fruits and flowers and crawling vines, snakeskin envelopes for her arms, bird feathers over her face, and a sack to cover her, all of her, up to her neck, where the dry plucked skin peered out, tied about with a bow. 2. Sitting so, she unlocked her throat, and spitting her last, defied her creditors. When I die, leaving loneliness triumphant on this earth, when I die as the impoverished sun snuffs out in a bag, when I die, let them tell all the world what I know, that the wise are devoured by fools with red eyes. Now let wild pigs claim the rest of you. One is called Old Beauty.
Does it have any personal association?
Perhaps Bunny was sort of characterizing herself, although she was hardly an old beauty. I mean, she was hardly old, and she was beautiful. I noticed there's another poem called Old Belle, which in this book, and it's the fact that these similar titles recur twice that make me think she might have been spoofing herself. God forgive me, I do not any longer care that I have broken tender habits of 100 years, that I should hurt you, touch me not at all. No longer bless you, no longer shall conceal from your defiant, eager, prurient alarm your fatness, thinness, your inability to dress, your little eyes, perhaps the question of your face. No longer will I ease you, bless you, so that you with me become the marvelous, as if the rest of life had not existed, had been an error or asleep, or victimized by fools or the very cruel. Go back to where you were. Some recent year, it happened that the touch of water or sun could no longer please my body nor caress. I try to keep cool only. In the afternoons, I sleep with the shades drawn, and in the evenings, rest. So soon again your importunity, crowding to speak to me in the theater lobby, at the wedding, or where my children learned to dance, amused me, and I was tender for you, aware of your pride or your pleasure in being seen, talking to me, of your eagerness to be known. You thought, all of you, always, that my soft hair, the lineage of my face, my eyes' felicity, set greatly as they were in shadowy sockets, and turned to you, enough that I could tell you what you were. I never knew what you were, perhaps never cared, except that I was tender and did not let you know. Now in the evening sun, I will not even listen. I like to whine, to quarrel with my children. I am become absorbed in the precise, the small. We'll watch a hummingbird for hours. We'll sit still. This one is called Born Old. I don't know, perhaps Bunny, because she was a little bit older than the rest of us. I mean, when you're in your early 20s, a difference of 2 years seems to be much bigger than it is later on. Had thought of herself as being old, since it occurs in the titles of these three poems. Part one. The house was on fire, he knew. He woke before dawn, and still as the upstairs breathing, he dressed and dropped from the windowsill and edged to the wall of the garden to creep unseen to the hill. Two. The woods were as hushed and as dark as his sleep, but he found his way. The forest squeaked, and a bird cried out, but he pushed them by, and the wet grass plucked at his knees. But he scrambled through to the valley. Three. He looked back once and saw where the ridge behind him was high, the lion, his love, grown little, standing anxious against the sky. But the house was on fire, he knew, and he blundered through to the valley. Four. The valley was flat as glass. He slept where he struck his head, but he shook with a spider's twitch and stretched in a caked web and woke in the dark for the lion who once struggled into his bed. Well, I think she would have become a really important poet. There's a quite original quality in her poetry, which sets it apart from the poetry that was being written at that time. It's kind of playful, as some of Frank O'Hara's poetry is, and yet it's also very bare and hard, and at the same and kind of lush at the same time. I don't know. I think that it would that poetry would have been what she would have excelled at. It's already kind of wonderful, and it would have gotten more so had she lived. I had no idea that she was that ill. I remember I was living in Paris at the time, and was very shocked. You know, it made me very sad.
Third of these three is about a chorus girl named Anne who is quitting her job, which is called, as you probably know, the line. It's addressed to society as a whole. Don't stop loving me when I leave the line. Next week's routines are done with roses and balloons and one with garlands, all the girls in green rehearsing now without me. I will yearn for large red paper roses that remain the same. Don't stop loving me, although someone else will have to do a toe-tap to the dance of the hours. Remember, I'm yours. I love you better than a knight in costume or another name. Say that I'm yours. I am. Our waltz clog and our elevés were ways like any ways to please but never face to face. You must not love me any longer just because I'm one out front with you alone. I know I'm one of you. I know that everywhere I'll go, you'll want to know my proper name. I'll sign. I love you and I'll always want you, Anne.
Mary Manning, Irish theater critic and author, talks with Charles Ruas and Susan Howe about her involvement with the Poets Theatre and her friendship with V.R. Lang.
I was walking through Harvard Yard one summer day. It all seemed to happen in the summer with Lyon Phillips. And I said to him, I've just been reading very good reports of the Lyric Theatre in Dublin, being very successful with verse plays. And he said, wouldn't it be great if we could start a verse theatre here, a little theatre devoted to verse plays? And I said, well, why don't you start it, Lyon? So I thought nothing more about it. And two or three days later, I got a telephone call from Lyon from the Eberhardt's house, Richard Eberhardt, the poet, saying they were having a meeting there, and would I come? And present at the meeting was Bill Matchett, myself, the two Eberhardts, Mrs. Eberhardt, and giving us all out nice drinks and everything. And Bunny Lang was there. She was there then. and a poet called Robert Bly, who was a rather bitter man, he seemed to me, because whenever I piped up, he said, well, let's call it the Shabby Theatre, shall we? I never forgave him, never. Anyway, that's really how it started. We started off with the first two, you know, the O'Hara and Bunny's play there. And we are greatly helped by Thornton Wilder, who was then teaching at Harvard. A great man. I loved him. We all loved him. But suddenly, in the middle of it was a very funny play. The first one was marvellous, Change Your Bedding. He stood up at the end. The audience roaring laughing throughout because it was funny and meant to be funny. At the end of it, Thornton Wilder stood up, shouted at us all and said, "How dare you? How dare you? This is disgusting. This is a sacred moment in the history of theatre. For the first time, poetry can be heard on the stage. Shut up, you beasts," he said. He was removed to MGH almost immediately afterwards. He was having a nervous breakdown. But I may say the audience also had one, and we didn't dare laugh throughout the next one for fear he'd stand up and shout at us all again. It made the evening.
Mary Manning, you've just returned from Ireland, where you're involved in the Lyric Theatre again?
No, there's no Lyric Theatre now. The Lyric Theatre died years ago. The Lyric Theatre was started by the Irish poet Austin Clark, and they allowed him to stage his productions in the Abbey Theatre on Sundays. And then they were so successful that he was allowed runs of a week or 2 weeks. And he really, it was all verse plays, and they were all immensely successful. He did his own plays and Yeats' plays, and very odd little unknown plays by Jack B. Yeats, you know, the artist. Plays which people don't really know very much about today, but I think are remarkable and should be revived.
So that the concept of the Poets' Theatre was influenced by the idea of the Abbey Theatre in Ireland?
Well, dimly, yes, but then it began to be, you know, the American poets suddenly emerged, all of them, a whole group, who have since become quite famous, very famous. And we moved into a dreadful little place on Palmer Street in Cambridge, and we constructed a little theatre there with 50 seats, and we all dressed in the old antique shop run by dear little old man Mr. Pankhurst. Filthy place, absolutely disgusting. And we all dressed there and made up and then ran round through snow, wind and rain up the back stairs into the theatre to perform in the most curious costumes, you know. Leprechauns, angels and things could be seen darting up Palmer Street around between 9 and 10 any evening.
Did you also get about during the day in these costumes the way Bunny
didn't.
Lang seemed to have?
Well, Bunny Lang was the only one who was perpetually in costume all her life. One costume to another. Her personality varied with the costumes. Her personality was not always as exquisite as Alison portrays it. She had her dark side, as we all do. She was an extremely egotistical person, and she was quite a bully, quite a dictator, and very hard to control. But she had a genius. She had a genius. Not only in her work, she had a genius in exciting people and getting them to do things. That was her true genius, I think. She was exciting.
At what point did you become involved in the actual direction of the theatre?
Well, we got a fellow called Eddie Thurman in, who was a professional director, and we paid the poor man about $2,000 a year for the season. And he worked awfully hard. He directed most of the productions. He was a pro. He was very good. He used to resign quite often in a rage and send telegrams to the meetings saying he was resigned. He had resigned. And then suddenly he would turn up at the next rehearsal. We waited. We knew we would just let things slide and Eddie would be back, and he always came back. But we passed from one frightful disaster to another, but just managed to survive. That's all I can say.
You managed to survive by giving these bigger readings?
We survived by, in the money thing, by having the sitwells over to give readings, which packed Memorial Hall. We survived by having Dylan Thomas, Brendan Behan, Dylan Thomas was marvelous. He read Milkwood for the first time. He read it himself at the Poets' Theatre. It was our great honour. In fact, he finished the last few scenes in my house, dashed them off before rushing round to the theatre.
To read them off?
Yes, yeah.
That must have been.
And, of course, we made money that way so that we could then help American poets.
But before you had a season of American plays written by American poets, you performed British and Irish poets.
Before we did that?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, but you mean before the Poets' Theatre started going into American stuff?
Yes.
Oh, no, no, no. The English poets were incidental. We did very little Yeats. We did Yeats once. But I did have the triumph of getting Sam Becker to send me All That Fall. And we put it on for the first time in the USA. It really was a radio play, as you know. But he allowed me to stage it. And Eddie Thoman directed it. And it was very successful as a play. Extremely successful. We did it behind scrim and had the figures moving behind the scrim lighted. And it's a very remarkable play. It's very autobiographical.
So you actually staged it as a shadow play?
We staged it more or less as a shadow play, yes, and in that tiny little theatre. But it ran for about 3 weeks and did very well. And Sam sent us endless, endless advice on how to stage it, and we disregarded everything.
But your greatest triumph was Finnegan's Wake.
Well, it was just mine, not the theatre's. We had very great triumph with Richard Wilbur, and after all, we did Lowell's Phaedre, first production of that. So they were quite triumphant. But my Finnegan's Wake did all right. It was called The Voice of Shem afterwards, and it's been produced all over the place since then. Done very well.
But what was your relationship to Bunny, would you say?
We were fighting constantly, and I felt she was very amateur, and I felt I had slight pretensions to professionalism. So we used to cross swords quite a lot in a very polite, tight-lipped way. But we never really came to blows. Once or twice, almost. But she and I then in the end were really great friends. We came together. In fact, two afternoons before she died, I sat with her in the hospital. She asked for me to sit with her. And I'll never forget it. The room was full of flowers, and I could see the lovely light on the Charles River and this dying girl in the bed. And she was full of life, asking me questions and wondering about the next, would they revive the Poets' Theatre, and how happy she would be if they did. It was 2 days later she was dead. And that was my last memory of her.
Did she say anything about her own life at that moment?
She was awfully happy. The last year, 15 months of her life, she was absolutely radiant. Bradley Phillips gave her everything that she always wanted, and he loved her, and she loved him. They travelled, they enjoyed themselves in Europe. I met her in London at a party, and she came in a perfectly beautiful white dress, and she was... I've never seen anybody light up. And then 3 weeks later, of course, she was in hospital, having radium treatment. She was very happy. She had 15 months of tremendous happiness. Mm-hmm. I know that. I think she was a very unhappy girl most of her life. She didn't know where she was going or what she was doing.
So that actually the Poets' Theatre was the structure around which she based her personality and her social life.
It was the flowering of a personality. She flowered in the Poets' Theatre. I could say that she really was a sort of sterile, groping person before then, but she flowered when she had the Poets' Theatre. And then it faded out a bit and she disappeared to New York. But this guy, Bradley Phillips, just gave her... She knew she was dying, you know, for 2 years. She knew it perfectly well. He just gave her 15 months of tremendous happiness, and Bunny was wonderful.
Hmm. How long were you able to keep the Poets' Theatre going after her?
We kept going quite a while. She died in 56. The Poets' Theatre really began dwindling and became rather dull and respectable. And we got grants for a playwright in residence, that sort of thing. I would say it died in 58. That's about the normal life of any kind of group movement, wouldn't you say?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did Was J.B. written for the...
We'd nothing. No, the only two plays of Archie MacLeish's we did were The Trojan Horse, wasn't it, Susan?
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't remember the name. Oh, This Music Crept By Me on the Water. They two nice, genteel verse plays that, of course, got a big audience with his name.
Why do you think that suddenly there were a lot of poets writing plays? Do you think it was...
Because they were given a place to do them. They were given encouragement, an audience. They were just brought out. They were beckoned out of the forest into the open.
What were the audiences like? What were...
Oh, tremendous. The audiences were all students from Harvard and from all over. And also professors being very, you know... I don't think this is quite thematic enough in the front row, you know, the sort of stuffiness. But on the whole, they did. They were very encouraging. Bill Alfred was awfully good. We had very good people.
But why do you think that a lyric theatre never took root in this country?
Nothing really of that sort of, like the group movement of the theatre in the USA. None of those things last, because they have a flower. They grow up as a flower and die as a flower and go in and die into the ashes.
They get successful and die, probably.
Yes. Way. And then those that made them become corrupted with success, and the beautiful innocence goes. Any movement like that must have innocence.
The voice you have heard was that of Violet Lang. Alison Lurie, poets John Ashbery, Robert Merrill, novelist Dee Wells, and Irish critic and writer Mary Manning, reminiscing about Violet Lang and the early 50s in Cambridge, Mass.
This is Charles Ruas. You've been listening to a selection from my historic archives.
With the cooperation of Clock Tower, these programs have been restored for broadcast on Clock Tower Radio, operating at clocktower.org.
The previous program was produced by Clock Tower Radio, clocktower.org, and is broadcast in partnership with Wave Farms WGXC 90.7 FM.